Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them, and religion and mythology more generally, in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the Cthulhu Mythos section of the Deities and Demigods book. That is a section that appeared only in the first and second printings, and was later removed following a licensing dispute. On the docket for today are Nyarlathotep, the messenger of the gods, and the Primordial Ones, what Call of Cthulhu players will recognize as the Elder Things, and everybody else calls Old Ones. So let's get started. Alright, first up we got Nyarlathotep. Nyarlathotep is one of the kind of recurring big names of the Cthulhu mythos, and that makes sense because he's one of the earliest. He appears in Lovecraft's story Nyarlathotep from 1920, and this actually predates Lovecraft's publication of Weird Tales. Indeed, I think it predates Weird Tales altogether. And in the story, Nyarlathotep is basically a kind of medicine show guy or a stage magician. He kind of goes from town to town giving these shows. And what they do is reveal the nature of reality to people, and that kind of breaks down the world. Hard to describe. The story is based on a dream that Lovecraft had, and he actually said that he wrote part of the story before completely waking, and as a result, it doesn't really have much in the way of a narrative. It's more just about evoking a particular set of images. So first, the narrator describes this sort of sense of unease and menace brooding around the world, and this seems to be reflected in the climate. It says, "There was a demoniac alteration in the sequence of the seasons. The autumn heat lingered fearsomely, and everyone felt that the world and perhaps the universe had passed from the control of known gods or forces to that of gods or forces which were unknown. And it was then that Nyarlathotep came out of Egypt. Who he was, none could tell, but he was of the old native blood and looked like a pharaoh. The fellaheen knelt when they saw him, yet could not say why. He said he had risen up out of the blackness of 27 centuries, and that he had heard messages from places not on this planet. Into the lands of civilization came Nyarlathotep, swarthy, slender, and sinister, always buying strange instruments of glass and metal, and combining them into instruments yet stranger. He spoke much of the sciences, of electricity, and psychology, and gave exhibitions of power which sent his spectators away speechless. Men advised one another to see Nyarlathotep, and shuddered. And where Nyarlathotep went, rest vanished, for the small hours were rent with the screams of nightmare. Never before had the screams of nightmare been such a public problem." Now, leaving aside the kind of exotic orientalizing stuff, Lovecraft. Here we have the Herald of the Apocalypse as kind of a stage magician who's also a scientist, and that sort of makes sense, particularly with the idea that, you know, occult knowledge and scientific knowledge are both ways to discover the meaninglessness of your own role in the universe, right? I mean, in Lovecraft, one is almost sort of a metaphor for the other. And Nyarlathotep would return in other Lovecraft stories, and he would not always be the same. You can see that Lovecraft is very fond of the character and, you know, reused some of the core concepts, but I think it's a mistake to try to look for consistency in his descriptions. I don't think he was trying to create consistency. In The Dreams in the Witch House, Nyarlathotep appears as basically the devil. You know, it's suggested that one of his many forms is the black man, that is the figure to whom witches were said to sell their souls. And in The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, he appears as yet another kind of trickster figure. He fools Randolph Carter and basically leads him to his doom. But on the other hand, in The Haunter of the Dark, he appears as basically a monster. Just a big, scary monster that cannot abide the presence of light. So there's a recurring image of darkness that seems to connect the idea of Nyarlathotep out of the color black. But other than that, not really a lot. He appears to be some kind of god of magical enlightenment, and he's described as a messenger of the gods. That's very much in Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath. He talks about how he's merely the agent of these other gods. Not the other gods, just some other gods. But the suggestion is that maybe they're kind of absentee landlords, and that Nyarlathotep is using this authority he derives from them to just kind of do whatever he feels like. So on the one hand, Nyarlathotep provides you with a lot of material for incorporating into a fantasy role-playing campaign, because he's the only god of the Cthulhu mythos that you could really have a conversation with. He'd be lying to you the whole time. But like, if you think about Cthulhu, humans can't understand Cthulhu, but also Cthulhu can't understand humans. By contrast, maybe humans can't grasp the interdimensional reality that is Nyarlathotep, but Nyarlathotep seems to have humans pretty clearly read. And he seems to delight in the idea that he is destroying them, breaking their grip on, not reality, but on the illusions that they use to function, and that they are choosing to do it, right? Nyarlathotep puts on a show, and people come to see it. The only thing they would have to do is not. But that's not really how we work. So, on the one hand, Nyarlathotep's personality and desire to interact with humanity make him a good kind of active agent in your fantasy game. The downside is that the Nyarlathotep of the story Nyarlathotep works, again, because he's violating people's sense of an ordered natural world. And you can see this kind of happening all around them. It's not just Nyarlathotep, but the sense of order in the world around people appears to be breaking down. And that is why they turn, perhaps, to Nyarlathotep, but of course he effectively betrays them. The problem with this is that it makes sense if you're starting from the premise of a world where most people are just ordinary and magic doesn't exist. Nyarlathotep is telling people that the rational world that they've always believed in isn't really real. But that's not the kind of world that most D&D characters believe in. If you tell D&D characters that the world is breaking down, the seasons aren't being what they're supposed to be, a great sense of doom and foreboding hangs over the land, etc., etc., what they're going to want to do is go find the blue jewel. You know, go and find the thing that going on a quest for will solve this problem. Nyarlathotep says not only nothing can solve this problem, but almost there isn't a problem. This is just kind of the way things are. I mean, this is a description of Nyarlathotep, again, from the story, which is only 3 or 4 pages long. He says, I remember when Nyarlathotep came to my city, the great, the old, the terrible city of unnumbered crimes. My friend had told me of him and of the impelling fascination and allurement of his revelations, and I burned with eagerness to explore his uttermost mysteries. So he goes to see the show. It was in the hot autumn that I went through the night with the restless crowds to see Nyarlathotep, through the stifling night and up the endless stairs into the choking room, and shadowed on a screen. I saw hooded forms amidst ruins and yellow, evil faces peering from behind fallen monuments. And I saw the world battling against blackness, against the waves of destruction from ultimate space, whirling, churning, struggling around the dimming, cooling sun. Then the sparks played amazingly around the heads of the spectators, and hair stood up on end, while shadows more grotesque than I can tell came out and squatted on the heads. And when I, who was colder and more scientific than the rest, mumbled a trembling protest about imposture and static electricity, Nyarlathotep drave us all out, down the dizzy stairs into the damp, hot, deserted midnight streets. I screamed aloud that I was not afraid, that I never could be afraid, and others screamed with me for solace. We swear to one another that the city was exactly the same, and still alive, and when the electric lights began to fade, we cursed the company over and over again. And they go out into this kind of magical post-apocalyptic world that's out there. So again, you know, I who was more rational and scientific than the rest. But what do you do in a world where people already believe in magic? You can have Nyarlathotep come along with a different kind of magic, but that's not as powerful as the image of someone showing magic to a scientific world, and indeed, blending magic with science. One thing you can do is put the interaction with Nyarlathotep into the past and have Nyarlathotep be the one who, say, taught humans to do magic. Particularly if you're in some kind of a setting where, like a la the Dragon Prince, humans aren't really supposed to have magical power. So instead of Nyarlathotep delivering the non-specific revelation of, I don't know, cosmic hopelessness that appears in the story, you'll have to have Nyarlathotep delivering a specific revelation, because it's easy to say everything you think you know is wrong when we know what the character thinks he knows. But in a fantasy setting, everything the character thinks he knows really is wrong, right? It's actually imaginary. There's not as much power to that revelation. So you'll have to be delivering a specific fact. One of the nice things about Nyarlathotep is that because he's a god who apparently appears in many forms, you could put him in the pantheon of every culture in your society in a different guise. That's the only thing that all these different pantheons have in common. They all have Nyarlathotep in them, or at least some form of him. Even cultures that are wise to the mythos might have some slightly different understanding of Nyarlathotep, particularly kind of an arrogant culture. So if you've got elves or whatever, they might definitely think, well, it's Nyarlathotep, you know. Obviously, these human rubes should stay away from him because he'll just break their tiny minds, but we can handle him. The other nice thing about Nyarlathotep is that he is kind of, you don't want to over-rely on this, but he is a god who conveys information. So every so often, you want to have someone pop up with a prophecy or a magic riddle or whatever, and you want to make sure that it's someone a little untrustworthy. Like, Nyarlathotep might tell you the truth, but he also might not. As opposed to if it's some you know, demon or something, and you're like, well, obviously that character's not telling the truth. Nyarlathotep has complex motivations in a way that maybe the other gods of the Cthulhu mythos don't. And that, you know, that can work. I guess what I mean is that Nyarlathotep has great potential. But with that great potential comes a great potential for being ordinary. You know, whenever you can talk to someone, he can turn out to be ordinary. So you have to think a little bit about how you're going to present Nyarlathotep in order that he can both be a character that you can communicate with, but also a character where the sense of danger is still present. Next on our list are the primordial ones, or as Lovecraft calls them, the old ones, or as the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game and most subsequent media call them, the Elder Things. Now, obviously, these appear in the story At the Mountains of Madness. So, At the Mountains of Madness is a late Lovecraft story. It was published in the spring and early summer of 1936, although, of course, actually, Lovecraft wrote it earlier than that. It was rejected from Weird Tales because it was too long, and then published in Astounding. And it's about a group of Antarctic explorers who discover that some of their comrades have apparently been killed by these alien creatures that were frozen and believed to be dead but seem to have come back to life. The creatures leave, and the protagonists turn up, find the dead people, and are sort of trying to investigate, find out what went on. They follow the trail until they find an ancient city created by these old ones, and they go down and down and down into the depths of it, learning more and more as they go about the sort of true history of the world, which includes, for example, the fact that humans were created by these old ones, possibly as a mistake, possibly as a joke. And as this experience goes on, they begin to feel a greater and greater sense of empathy with the old ones. Initially, the old ones are described in terms that would suggest horror. So they're called monstrosities. Sometimes there's a whole thing about how the dogs of the expedition are anxious when they're around them, which is a very kind of characteristic thing for a monster. And so the initial image that you get of them is very sinister. And why not? I mean, they've dissected a human, which is kind of a sinister thing to do, but gradually we come to realize, you know, well, the human dissected one of them. You know, they woke up and they didn't know what was going on and they tried to find out. In fact, we get a striking moment of empathy with the alien toward the end of At the Mountains of Madness. They find the bodies of the old ones, which have been killed off by the Shoggoths, who we'll talk about, obviously, in more detail when we get to them. And of finding them and seeing that the Shoggoths are sort of becoming intelligent and have murdered one of these old ones, it says, "And now, when Danforth and I saw the freshly glistening and reflectively iridescent black slime, which clung thickly to those headless bodies and stank obscenely with that new, unknown odor whose cause only a diseased fancy could envisage, clung to those bodies and sparkled less voluminously on a smooth part of the accursedly resculptured wall in a series of grouped dots, we understood the quality of cosmic fear to its uttermost depths. It was not fear of those four missing others. For all too well did we suspect they would do no harm again. Poor devils. After all, they were not evil things of their kind. They were the men of another age and another order of being. Nature had played a hellish jest on them, as it will on any others that human madness, callousness, or cruelty may hereafter drag up in that hideously dead or sleeping polar waste. And this was their tragic homecoming. They had not been even savages. For what indeed had they done, that awful awakening in the cold of an unknown epoch? Perhaps an attack by the furry, frantically barking quadrupeds, and a day's defense against them, and the equally frantic white simians with the queer wrappings and paraphernalia. Poor Lake, poor Gedney, and poor old ones. Scientists to the last, what had they done that we would not have done in their place? God, what intelligence and persistence! What a facing of the incredible! Just as those carven kinsmen and forebears had faced things only a little less incredible. Radiates, vegetables, monstrosities, star spawn, whatever they had been, they were men. They had crossed the icy peaks on whose templed slopes they had once worshipped and roamed among the tree ferns. They had found their dead city brooding under its curse and had read its carven latter days as we had done. They had tried to reach their living fellows in fabled depths of blackness they had never seen. And what had they found? The answer then is that they have found the Shoggoths, and then the Shoggoths come after our heroes, who have to make a hasty retreat. So, the thing about the old ones is that there's a double substitution, and this is also kind of the trick that Lovecraft pulls in The Shadow Out of Time with the Great Race of Yith, where initially the Great Race of Yith are the mystery behind this strange thing that's happened to Peasley. but gradually you stop being frightened by them and begin to become fascinated by them. The Great Race of Yith, I mean, okay, they're a bunch of meddling, time-traveling so-and-sos, but they're not such bad guys, not necessarily. But then, the problem is that the Great Race of Yith aren't around anymore, you have the Flying Polyps. And it's the same with the old ones. Yeah, you could be like them, but they're dead now, and Shoggoths aren't interested in your cultural comparison. So, what this is a dungeon. Indeed, arguably a mega dungeon. Old ones, outside of their context, aren't terribly interesting, right? The whole deal is that they are relics of an ancient species that has awakened in the modern day, gone on a bit of a rampage, and is trying to get back to their old base, their old headquarters, to see if any of their kind are still alive. And when they get there, they find out that no, their kind are not still alive. The upper levels are all desolate and wasted, so they go down and down and down further into the depths, looking for any possible survivors, only to discover that it's full of the monstrous creatures that they, in their hubris, created, but which later destroyed them. And it seems like a dungeon to me, right? I mean, that's pretty straightforward. It's even got the little pre-dungeon scenario where the PCs discover some weird crime committed while some people were, like, investigating a tomb or whatever. You can even have a little mini dungeon in the first excavation site, and then they follow the trail of the killer until they come to the second dungeon, and maybe the resurrected, you know, Yuan-Ti or whatever they are, have something that allows them to skip past all the traps and baddies that the PCs have to face on the upper levels, because, like, okay, sure, the above ground levels were colonized by these bugbears, but surely the lower levels are still holding out, surely? And then they goofed up and released an even greater evil on the world, and the PCs have to overcome it, right? That sounds like D&D 101. So, the machinations of the old ones are not terribly interesting, and they're, you know, Lovecraft does a great job of giving them this really weird science fictional description. Lovecraft good at making a weird-looking alien. Sometimes they're absurd, but I don't think that's the case with the old ones. I think they look really good. And what Dungeons & Dragons thing doesn't have lost civilizations? Down there in the depths, there could be all kinds of magic items and pieces of advanced technology and gold and what have you. The pathetic legacy of a once mighty civilization destroyed by its own creations, and frankly, I think Shoggoths are an excellent choice for this, as we'll talk about them next time. It's got a sense of grandeur and dignity, and it relies on this metaphor that appears a lot in Lovecraft, which is the descent into the depths of the earth, let's call it, for Dungeons & Dragons purposes. Which is to say, basically, that going deeper underground is going further into the past, is going further down into the subconscious, into sleep and the land of dreams, into death, into the other world. You can see an example of this, for example, in the Lovecraft story, The Rats in the Walls, where as the character goes further and further underground, he regresses further and further along his family tree. He basically goes further not only into his own past, but into the historical past. He starts speaking in like Middle English, and then he starts speaking in Latin. He starts speaking in Gaelic, although Irish, rather than the kind of Brittonic dialect that would have been spoken in the area, which is actually linguistic nitpicking, is how Robert E. Howard and H.P. Lovecraft got in touch with each other. But that's a side point. So feel like the thing about this is that you don't really need to know anything about the old ones themselves in order to make this scenario work. In fact, in the story at the Mountains of Madness, the old ones don't ever really appear. We always see what they've been doing. We see their bodies. We see the bodies of people they've killed. But a human and an old one don't interact on the page, so to speak. We find legacies of that interaction. And that helps keep them mysterious. You almost don't want to have these creatures turn up and just, like, have a chat with a person. That's going to demythologize them. That's the danger with Nyarlathotep, right? You want to constantly be finding evidence of the things they've done. And at the end, when they've all been Shoggoth murdered and you're having to get at your Shoggoth killing weapons, you have to think regretfully to yourself, oh, what great secrets might they have shared with us? I don't feel so bad that they killed Uncle Chester now. And that's the deal with the old ones. Or, as they're called here, the primordial ones. You can call them the Elder Things, you can call them whatever you like. It doesn't matter what they are. What they have to be is some race that once existed in your D&D world, but no longer does. And it's also a fantastic time to use one weird goofball race from a monster book that you don't really have a place for in your world's ecology. Like, how many major factions am I expected to have? I love Githzerai, but they're never going to come up. Well, now's the time. Time to bust out that intelligent monster that you like, but that's never actually going to be in your campaign because there's only so many you can fit in your world building, right? Right. So I think the story at the Mountains of Madness is fantastic D&D inspiration, and I think that the specifics of the old ones are kind of irrelevant to how good that story is going to be in your game. Now, what's not irrelevant are the Shoggoths, and Shoggoths are going to be one of the things that we'll be talking about next time. So please join me then as we conclude this easy do-it-yourself at the Mountains of Madness dungeon design on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.